Thank you for joining us. In this podcast, we are real people talking about real things, child abuse and neglect, a topic that is all too often left in the shadows of silence, leaving survivors alone, fearful, and oftentimes without a voice. We're having conversations to become louder than silence. It is here where we will invite you to join us and be the change needed to end child abuse and neglect. My name is Lori Poland, and I am the Executive Director of the National Foundation to End Child Abuse and Neglect. Thank you so much for joining us today and listening in. Our mission is to end child abuse and neglect in our lifetime, and the way that we see doing that is by uniting the voices of the tens of millions of people who have been impacted and affected by child abuse and neglect in one way or another.
We are in a phenomenal opportunity in our world where we can Zoom in, voice in, talk from different parts of the country. And today, our guest is truly one colleague that I have admired and known for about 6 years now. From the moment I met him, he is just a really tender, genuine, honest person. And I have had the pleasure of getting to know Des as one of our board members at NCAN, and is probably one of the most brilliant researchers I've ever known. I don't know a ton of researchers, but I'm going to put you up in the category of brilliant because I can and I want to. So I do welcome Des Runyon. He is a doctor and in North Carolina, and we're just really, really grateful that you're here, Des. Why don't you go ahead and let our listeners get to know you and just introduce yourself and what you do, what you've done in the world.
Sure. As Lori said, my name is Des Runyon. I was a pediatrician. I'm now retired, but I had a long career at the University of North Carolina after doing a 2-year research fellowship back in the early 80s, and then stayed in North Carolina for much of my career until I went in 2011 to Denver, Colorado, where I was asked to head the Kemp Center, the Child Abuse Center at the University of Colorado, and the oldest child abuse center in the world. Mm-hmm. And I did that for 7 years, and then I decided to take a step back, and I'm back in North Carolina meeting with child abuse teams and doing a little bit of research, but not doing very much clinical work now, and actually seeing my grandchildren.
Very cool. Yes, grandchildren sound like it's the way to go. I hear a lot of grandparents say, if we could just skip right over to grandparenting, it's so joyful. So I hear that a lot. And Dr. Krugman, who Des and I both know, often is known to say that the hardest years of parenting are the first 45. So I think you're right around there, I would say, maybe even just slightly under that. So you've only got a couple years left of the challenges of parenting. But Des, thank you again for being here. And the focus of this section of our podcast right now is really just helping our listeners understand child abuse and neglect. I think that there can be a lot of misunderstandings. There can be a lot of assumptions. And then there can just like be a lot of unknowns. It's something that when people say child abuse, it immediately ignites a sense of self-protection or caution or something that causes people to pause. And I would say a lot of people, that pause is followed with avoidance. And so I'm sure you've run into that. I know I certainly have in my career. And so, but the big piece that I've learned so much from you around is child neglect specifically. You've done a lot of research on child neglect and really just have a plethora of knowledge around it. And I was just hoping that today you could help educate and inform our listeners about what is child neglect and what category is categorized as neglectful, and is there a spectrum, you know? So I just want to talk about that.
Yeah, I was hoping for an easier question.
I'll come back tomorrow.
And the reason I say that is because neglect really is difficult to define. Yeah. I mean, when I was a medical student up in Minnesota, We had some Native American tribes who the parents would go down to the Twin Cities to earn income during the winter and leave their kids with all their extended relatives. And that was perfectly okay. And everybody understood that and was very supportive. But sometimes that got reported to Child Protective Services as the parents have abandoned their children and not understanding kind of the cultural nuances of kind of what that felt like.
Yeah. And the
definition is basically acts of omission. I mean, there's child abuse is acts of commission that parents do that either cause harm or cause the risk of harm. But there are things we don't do that cause harm or cause the risk of harm. Not putting up railings that let kids fall downstairs and things like that. Those are, you didn't push the kid down the stairs, but you neglected the opportunity to keep it from happening when sure. It was foreseeable. So that neglect is the failure of, or the omission of doing something you should have done. And then of course, most of the time, nobody ever sees that. I mean, I discovered after many years that my neighbor had been leaving her 11-year-old child home alone most of the day while she went off to work as a nurse after her husband left. And it never came to the attention of any of the neighbors, and we didn't know that was going on. It was actually going on for several years before. And we could have been more helpful and supportive and helping her work out, but we didn't even know. But I think, and then comes a quite interesting question, when is it okay to leave your kid home alone for an hour? At what age can you do that? We did a survey back in 2007 in North Carolina. We asked people about that behavior and when they did it, and found that basically nobody, there was one outlier, but basically nobody left the kids home alone for an hour who are under six. But there were a significant number, in fact, almost 30% of 10-year-olds were left home for an hour or more. The question is kind of, well, when is that okay and when it's not okay? It probably depends somewhat on the kid.
Yeah, emotional development, maturity.
But there is, at some point, I mean, most of us would think that, you know, 5-year-old being left home alone unsupervised is probably not a good idea.
Sure. And
most of us would probably think that a 12 or 13-year-old could probably be trusted for an hour home without getting into trouble. But where's the dividing line? And so there's some kind of cultural nuances in terms of what's acceptable, and it's probably what happened to their parents and their prior experience. But there's some kids that are going to get into trouble at age 14 if they're left home for an hour. And there are other kids that, you know, you don't have to worry about at all. But some of this is a little squishy. And that's why I said it's a hard question. I mean, it's acts of omission that result in harm or the potential for harm. And the potential for harm is the part that, I mean, you could say, well, a 10-year-old left home alone for an hour has the potential for harm. But you have to think about, well, how likely is that? And what the risks were for that. But if a child is left home alone at age 7 in a household that has a gun and pulls out the gun and playing with it and shoots another kid, that sounds pretty neglectful.
Yeah, right. Right. And so it almost, what I'm hearing you say is that it really feels very subjective, right? And so it's like a case by case basis almost. And that I would imagine that most parents at some point in their parenting years have that decision to make, like what you, and then add in, as you just described, your next door neighbor being a single parent, or being, you know, needing to have multiple jobs in order to provide, or like the having a guardrail or a gate on the stairwell, you know, like I think that that every parent, at least I certainly have only, I've never met a parent who's like, oh, this is easy, I've got this, I know all the right decisions at all the right times and exactly what's most appropriate. And you know, and I've studied children and child development and the impacts of all of those things for a lot of years, and I still don't even know all the answers. So it sounds very subjective. And so what is that? I mean, then what, right? Like,
And you've outlined a couple of the complexities of it. I mean, what if you did it one time because there was some urgent need for you to be someplace and you left your kid home for an hour once, is that a big deal? But if you do it, you know, every week or every day, is it something different? And what's the threshold for when it's okay and not okay? Mm-hmm. We did our survey of North Carolina and South Carolina parents about how they took care of their kids. I think it was 8% of the kids were left under six had been left home alone for more than an hour on three or more occasions in the last year. So we used the three times as kind of our, we figured one time or two times, but three times started to be a too much of a pattern. So we concluded in our paper that 8% of parents of kids under six were kind of pushing the threshold for neglect in terms of leaving kids home alone. Mm. And of course, that's only one of the, I mean, that's a question that we asked. One of the other questions we asked was, has your child ever been injured when you or another adult should have been watching and mm-hmm. weren't paying attention? And it turns out that that's almost 20, I think it was close to 20% of kids. 20% of parents said that they had done that in the last year.
Wow.
So there was a lot of guilt that we've uncovered of parents who, whose kids had been injured. And then we found another 8% who said that they had not taken their kid to the doctor when they thought they needed their kid taken to the doctor.
Interesting.
And those numbers are dramatically higher than official reports of neglect to social service agencies. So self-report are, it's close to 10 or 12 times what social services knows about in terms of we ask parents directly what they've done.
Right. Right. Well, and even with that, like, first of all, I would imagine that the majority of instances, just like so many things, right? But the majority of instances aren't social services applicable or, mm-hmm. or even that people would think to call social services for something like that, right? It would be, you know, maybe they are, the, a child is injured, they go to the hospital and the doctor says, how does this happen? And then there's a mandatory reporting situation. So I would imagine that there's probably more of the injury by neglect that occurs, the reports occur through the reporting of somebody else as opposed to a self-report by a parent.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, yeah. we wrestle with that. I mean, I'm currently sitting in weekly with two different child abuse teams, and we talk about cases that come in, and there are cases that don't get reported, that they decide, well, you know, the kid rolled off the couch and got a skull fracture. The infant rolled off the couch and got a skull fracture. If the parent, if it seems like the parent was taking precautions and the kid still managed to roll off the couch, that doesn't get reported. But if a parent is, seems to be pretty nonchalant about it and not having taken due care, but then you get into some interesting situations. If that's the case, you have to worry about, you know, if is it a poor family or a black family or a, you know, a non-white family that gets reported. So you have to be, so hospitals more and more setting up protocols.
Yeah.
Having kind of standard.
So that there isn't a racial bias or a prejudice.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, and the other thing, the note that I made earlier when you were talking about these surveys, I mean, first of all, I keep thinking about, you know, I no longer drink because I really loved wine, and 2 to 3 glasses of wine on a, you know, 4 to 5 days a week was very normal for me. And at some point, you know, I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. This is actually not good for me. And I didn't like how I was. And so, but I do remember that being at the doctor's offices or whatever, and the doctor would say, you know, how often do you drink? And I would always under report. Like, I'd be like, well, I'll have a glass, you know, what, periodically, but because I was afraid. And like you mentioned shame, right? Mm-hmm. Or guilt. And I was afraid of being judged. I was afraid because I wasn't comfortable with having 2 to 3 glasses, you know, 3 to 4 times a week. And so I didn't want this doctor to confirm my own shame and guilt. And I didn't want to be judged. I didn't want to be questioned in my, all of the other areas of my life. And so what's interesting is that these parents are reporting the in these surveys, and I would imagine that your surveys are anonymous, are they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, they're anonymous.
Yeah, and so do you, when you guys do surveys like this or try to understand these things, do you take into account, like, you know, maybe just under reporting or like, you know, maybe a lack of admission simply because of that human element. Is that ever a reality?
Yeah. I mean, we acknowledge it that we're probably getting an underreport, and yet it's still many times, some 10 to 12 times higher than official reports.
Right, like the social services sees.
From social service reports or reports that the agencies know about. So it's a different perspective, and it still is an underreport, but it's probably closer to the truth. And there are some questions that are kind of less stigmatizing, they may get more accurate on, and others less stigmatizing. So I'm assuming that when, you know, if 8% of parents have left their kids home alone for an hour under age six, that it probably is, you know, 12 or 14%, not percent, but it's still dramatically higher than the number that social services ever has heard about.
Right.
So it's perspective. Yeah. And we acknowledge that that's a difference in perspective.
Yeah.
Interestingly, when we do this work internationally, I mean, we ask the similar questions in India and Egypt and the Philippines. Mm-hmm. In India, there's no reporting mechanism. There's no social services. And and the reports are all dramatically higher than they are in the U.S. for both physical.
When you do the surveys, they're like the answers are, I've done this more.
Yes. Dramatically higher rates in low-income countries.
Okay.
But that some of that may be, in fact, that there's no stigma attached because.
Yes.
So I mean, that's easier to think about in terms of physical abuse. So in the United States, when we did the same survey about neglect, we asked about if they'd ever shaken the child to discipline them. And when we did that survey, it was 2.6% of parents in North and South Carolina told us they'd shaken a kid under two to discipline them. Mm-hmm. We were worried about abusive head trauma. When we did that same survey in India, it was 44%. And there was one community that was over 60%. So but there was also no awareness or stigma about shaking. It looked like a pretty appropriate way. And in fact, if you give a kid a mild concussion, they stop crying. So shaking a child to stop them crying may appear to be someone who's uneducated, may appear to be a very effective method of stopping that.
Wow, how interesting. And so then let's go there, Des. Let's talk about that stigma of the, you know, like the added shame and guilt of the system, right? The system that's designed or intended, maybe not designed, but the system of child welfare, at least in the US, is intended to protect and help families. Mm-hmm. And what the role that it has ended up playing is different than that. You know, I would guess that most people view it differently, hence why we do underreport or we don't ask for help. And there's an assumption that I should know and that I have to do it. Or if I get in trouble, my kid will be taken. Right. So, you know, the families that you had reported earlier that didn't take their child to the doctor when they should have, you know, was that correlated with the fear of getting in trouble? And, you know, that the worry of somebody else coming in and intervening.
Well, so mandated reporting is clearly something that's controversial. And here in North Carolina, we're required to report physical abuse and we're allowed to report neglect, but we actually are not required to report neglect. Mm-hmm. The law is written in such a way that that's more optional. And I think the reason for that is because of definitions and also there may be other ways that a professional can potentially help and support a family short of making a report to social services. Mm. But some of that may actually, I have many colleagues and friends who work in social services, but it may be that they're kind of so focused on kind of blame and kind of sorting things out that trying to get them to be the assistance agency as opposed to the punishment agency is something that they've kind of lost track of.
Yeah, like the punitive response.
Yeah, so we worked on trying to develop a prevention program in Colorado called Safe Care, which was specifically designed to prevent neglect. And it was parents were trained about injuries and accidents and appropriate use of medical care and things like that. So the parents were, and the Safe Care program, it originally was developed as for families that were reported and substantiated. by social services, and then they could get it. The Colorado version, we experimented partly through a misunderstanding of the legislature and the funding. The people that were eligible for safe care in Colorado were people who had not been substantiated, which actually made it an interesting problem, because when you're substantiated, social services can say, you're going to do this program or we're going to take your kid and put them in foster care. When you haven't substantiated the case and you're saying, we're offering you this program, the parents can say, okay, or they can say, get lost. And there's no, so the sign up, the take up when social services recommended safe care was 11% in Colorado.
Okay.
When WHO made the referral to social services, and it wasn't social service, I mean, to safe care, this home education program of 30 sessions of home education where they come into your home.
Yeah.
When the recommendation was made by a health professional, the take up was more than twice as high.
Wow.
So when the Department of Social Services said, we think this would be a good program for you, a lot of people voted with their feet not to do it. But when their family physician or the nurse in newborn nursery or somebody along the way made the recommendation for safe care, the take up was a lot higher. So I think that was.
Yeah, go ahead. I was just going to ask what you're about to answer.
I think it's stigma. I mean, when yeah. social services tells you, you've kind of been identified as the bad person.
Yeah.
Whereas when the healthcare professional offers it to you, it's not so much stigma as much as, hey, here's a program you can benefit from.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's free. And that looks like a real benefit as opposed to punishment.
Yeah. And, the programs that come to mind in terms of that are nurse family partnership versus home visiting, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know enough about home visiting, but when you have a nurse come into the home versus a social worker come into the home, there's a big difference on the collaborative approach.
Yeah, when the nurse comes in, I mean, we all have the impression the healthcare system is something that's there to help us. And a nurse comes in, and nurses, I mean, they do unpleasant things like give you shots, but they also are knowledgeable people that give you advice and are looked at as professionals who can be helpful. And social services are the people that, if you don't toe the line, they can take your kid away. And so it's definitely something different. I once got myself in trouble by suggesting that maybe what we ought to do is divide social services into one third and two thirds, and the two thirds would not have the power to take kids away. Mm-hmm. And the other one third would all be moved over to the police department and would have to have police powers in order to take the kids away, so that social services couldn't take the kids away without having the police involved.
Interesting.
Because I thought that would make the reception for all the others a lot better, because they're there to help as opposed to there to.
Yeah.
And there are some places that have experimented with combining the nurses and the social workers in the same department and having a kind of health and human department, human services department.
Or even having like a social worker within the doctor's office, right? Like, and not social services social worker, but just a social worker, like
The health department social worker, the Tri-County Health Department in Colorado had a program where a public health nurse would go out with the first visit to social services and be involved, and you would have a nurse that was involved as part of the intake into the child protective services system. And I'm not sure what's happening with that now, because I know Tri-County is broken up, but their response is totally different.
Yeah. And how interesting the correlation, though, kind of circling us back to earlier, the correlation between shame and guilt and neglect. Right?
Well, one thing that we shouldn't overlook is poverty. When people don't have enough money, they come up with solutions that include leaving kids home alone while they go work and
leaving children to watch other children.
Exactly. And so Terry Rassian is a researcher at Connecticut who's written about about minimum wage. And it turns out that for every dollar minimum wage, there's a 9% reduction in neglect reports to social services. Mm. And other reports have shown that it's the earned income tax credit is actually, there are some states where you can get it as cash and others you just get credit against your taxes. Mm-hmm. And states that you can get it as cash, they have lower rates of child maltreatment and child neglect.
I just saw that report, like the EITC easiest
right.
public health, you know, like solution for eliminating neglect is, I think, like something along the title of that paper. It was really well done. So
and the other one that we looked at was the low income housing tax credit, which is something that the federal government gives to money to states, and they partition out to builders or people who provide low income housing. And it turns out that also has a protective effect, that there, it's not a dramatic effect, but they can show the states that adopted and expanded their low income tax credit above the mean had about a 4% reduction in child maltreatment, in particular neglect. So it's 4% is not a great deal, but if you combine 4% for that, we showed a number of years ago in a research that teen parents are disproportionately represented for both abuse and neglect and, unfortunately, sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. Part of it, they may leave their kids with people that they shouldn't leave their kids with. And it turns out that the states that have widely adopted family planning access for teens have dramatically lower child abuse rates. And particularly child neglect rates and child sex abuse rates are all declined. We found a 9% decline in child neglect.
9%, wow.
Decline in teen pregnancy.
That's huge. I feel like we could talk for hours. I just feel like you are a reservoir or an encyclopedia of data and knowledge. And every time I talk to you, there are so many different cul-de-sacs and avenues and routes that we could go. And because our listeners are here with us, and I want to honor and respect their time, and I would love to kind of loop us back in and maybe just package up what you've shared today. And I think one thing I'd really love to hear from you that our listeners could benefit from is, like, what can they do about neglect within their own communities? If they see or know of a neighbor, or they see something that is neglectful, what would be a good thing for somebody that's listening to do?
I can divide it into kind of pre-contact with, I mean, there's public policies that they can support. Teen,
sure.
Reducing teen parenting has a dramatic impact.
Yes.
Getting teens access to birth control. And so supportive of efforts to try and have health departments expand those services are really important. And then the other thing is, if you get to know your social workers and the agency outside of kind of having to make a report, if you've made an effort to kind of, and I recommend this for professionals who are likely to have to make a report, you should get to know your social service agency, not around the case, but you ought to go introduce yourself, find out who they are, kind of have a name. And then when you have a concern, you have somebody who you can talk to at the
liaison.
That person can give you guidance as to whether, you know, will this get, I'm not going to make a report if this isn't going to get anybody's attention and they're not going to get excited about this. Yeah. So it's good to have kind of a knowledge about what the agency's looking for and what they're willing to step into, or what kind of documentation they need before they're going to make an effort.
So what about something that maybe somebody could do that wouldn't involve social services?
I think, you know, everybody's heard the expression, but it takes a community to raise a child. I mean, the kind of work that people get involved in doing, working with the schools, supporting young parents, you know, even as something as simple as, you know, providing a donut for a kid who's in the store. And when you're seeing a mother coping with a kid who's having a breakdown and saying, and distracting the kid for a moment. I mean, people worry you're going to poison kids or steal kids or whatever, but I mean, support for a parent who's really having a tough time is a good place to start.
A good place to start. I love that. And so then I think the next question, Des, that I'd love to have answer is a three-part question. And the question is, how can they help? And the first part of that is how can they help themselves, each other, and their community? And I think you tapped into that a little bit on what people can do, but is there anything you want to dive into a little bit more with how people can help themselves avoid or stay kind of really away from that guilt and shame around omission of protecting their children?
Oh, that's right. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, people are shamed for calling on resources, and that's something that we need to kind of get around. I mean, programs, public library programs, school programs for family resource centers, things like that, that have lots of information. People should feel that, hey, that's there for us and we can use that and not be stigmatized about going and using the Family Resource Center to get information. You know, everybody doesn't know the answers to all these different things, and it's expensive and time consuming to go see your local pediatrician and get that advice. And so Family Resource Centers at the schools and communities can be a real can be a place to start.
Yeah.
And if you can't get help there, boy, there, I mean, every university has a child development program. Or if you're fortunate enough to be listening to this in Colorado, you should call the Kemp Center and say, you know, I'd really like to help and I'd like to get help and I'd like to become involved in this. And the Kemp Center will find ways to do that for you.
Yeah. Love it. Great.
The Tennyson Center. I mean, there are a number of programs.
Mount St. Vincent's. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And excellent. If you're listening to me from North Carolina, there's the University of North Carolina and Duke University both have child protection teams, but they also have departments of social work and they have other folks that you can turn to for resources. And so it's actually, if you're willing to reach out, it's not so hard to find help.
Yeah. And, you know, interestingly, a lot of our listeners are international. And so I think I really loved earlier how you talked about the comparison between the U.S. and other countries. And so that was really beneficial as well. Is there anything that you would suggest just parents in general, whether they are in Colorado or North Carolina or Saudi Arabia or whatever, is there anything in general that you would just say around neglect for parents?
Well, most of the world has a child helpline system where they can go, Child Help International. Many countries have local programs that are connected to the international program. And so if you're not in the U.S., Child Help International or Child Helpline or one of those services is the place to call.
Great. And I'll go ahead and put that in our show notes so that our listeners have information about that and where to go and who to call. And Des, I just really want to thank you again for being who you are and all of the work and commitment and dedication you've done with children and families in your career. Des's wife, for everybody who's listening, is a public health professional as well. And she is equally as phenomenal. And every time I talk to Des, I'm like, I just love your wife because she and I think very similarly, at least. So my ego says to love Carol for sure. But it's neat to see the impact that you've both had on the world. And everywhere you go, you think about how to do better for communities, children, and families. And it's so obvious. It just radiates out of the two of you. And that's a very admirable thing to carry with you. And I thank you for doing that. And thank you for being a part of that, for me at least.
So, thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
Reminder, Jeff Jeffries, a comedian from Australia, always says, we can all do better.
Yes, that's it. That is true. Well, thank you everybody for listening to the Louder Than Silence podcast. I'm Lori Poland. We are here with Dr. Des Runyon, and I hope you all come back again and listen again. Have a great day. Take care. I want to thank each of you again for joining us today and listening in. If you or someone you know is being abused, please call 1-800-4-A-CHILD. To learn more about NDCAN, visit www.ndcan.org or find us on all social media platforms. Join us in being louder than silence and being a part of the change. Please leave a comment, like our podcast, or share with your friends. The more the word spreads, the more of a collective impact we can have.